Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next, producer picks of the week. Highlights of the best What's Next episodes heard during the previous week. On today's show, we'll hear two segments from episodes that aired this week, starting with...
Up against the same battle that every commercial real estate owner in Buffalo is up against, and that's there's a lack of market for office space. So we tossed around the idea of converting the top two floors of the Brisbane building into housing.
Monday's episode with Bob Shibley and Jake Schneider. We'll then close with...
I think as a society, our banks have gotten increasingly complex. And so banks are often doing many more roles. And so we've started to forget what the base mission of the bank is. And we see more of chasing sort of high revenue opportunities and not paying close attention to the clients that are, in fact, the backbone of the bank.
Tuesday's episode with Mary-Kate Loftus and Lauren Schellinger. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in. First, we revisit a conversation about how the COVID-19 pandemic altered downtown Buffalo and what the future of office space looks like in the area. WBFO's Jim Fink sits down with Bob Shibley, the former dean of the UB School of Architecture, and Jake Schneider, a local developer and entrepreneur who's worked on multiple downtown projects.
Let's talk about some eyesores that are hurting downtown. The A&E's building, the former Adams Mark Hotel. What do we do to help find a solution for those buildings? Granted, both are privately owned. There's different set of issues with each building.
Everything we do to make downtown more vital and attractive increases the pressure on properties like that to join the chorus. So that would be my answer, is build around and create the environment that makes it more attractive and more urgent to develop those properties. They've been in distress for a long time. There's no magic bullet that's going to fix that, except as downtown becomes more vital, it becomes more profit-making to develop those properties as well.
There was some thought not too long ago of maybe with the A&E's even trying to have the city take it over through eminent domain. Mm-hmm. Change of administration on the second floor, I'm not sure where that is. Would that be a viable route for the A&E's building?
It's one of those tools that nobody likes to use and has had difficulty across the state in being employed. But it the logic of it is sound. And the amount of time these buildings have been offline or largely offline suggests they should be considered eminent domain.
Even Darrell Carter's buildings in the cobblestone.
Yep.
And even something like eminent domain might have saved the Great Northern Elevator if the city had the... So desire to move forward on that. Yeah.
It's a powerful tool, but again, politically it's a difficult choice to make.
I support it 100%. I think it's unfair. You mentioned you build up around it. Well, A&E's is a perfect example of almost everything's built up around it, and you might argue the reason it's not fully built is because of A&E's, but that's been an ownership nightmare. Mm-hmm. It's been kicked around. I think that's a perfect example.
Nobody knows who really owns it.
Yeah, it's been a lifetime. It's been sitting there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it does have value. And it would be a great missing tooth to repair. So if there was ever a reason to utilize eminent domain in spite of its challenges, I think that would be a great one. And the cobblestone's another example. Look what happened there. Mm-hmm. There should be an easier way to enact eminent domain. And when people are not you know, paying their taxes and maintaining their property, that's a civic responsibility. It should trigger that. I mean, if you want to avoid that happening to your property, well, then, you know, maintain your property and pay your taxes.
You mentioned in the break the Brisbane building, and there was some talk at one point about it going residential, and now it's, I mean, they've landed some new tenants, but there are some issues.
Yeah, let me tell you what I know about that. So Peter Hunt is a friend of mine. I've been on his radio show, and I know he's spoken about this himself, so I'm not speaking out of school here, but as an architect, I've worked for Peter at the Brisbane building to do a number of nice projects that are eligible for historic tax credits because the Brisbane building is, in fact, a beautiful historic building. He's up against the same battle that every commercial real estate owner in Buffalo is up against, and that's there's a lack of market for office space. So we tossed around the idea of converting the top two floors of the Brisbane building into housing. And that would be eligible for historic tax credits. So he could create a hybrid building, which has been done around the country, and you'd still maintain some of it as office space, and people could have a live-work environment. It's a perfect example of a building that's ripe for that type of development. He is pursuing that. I don't know where he stands, but you know, the banks are not as willing to jump on a project like that as they used to be. So there are still hurdles. But I think the point is that every historic building that is currently used in the downtown that is used as an office building is a candidate for this type of redevelopment. And the more of it that happens, the less pressure you put on the rest of the commercial real estate that is vacant. As you mentioned, 16% of 33 million, that's a lot of space.
Yes,
but,
it is.
But a good portion of that is in historic buildings that would be eligible for that incentive. So that's out there. But like I mentioned earlier offline, you know, the owners have to have an appetite. And Peter is extremely savvy when it comes to all things real estate. And it's been a very slow conversation. He's very interested in doing it, but there, it's nothing that he's rushing to do. So I think there's some education required, and but that's another opportunity. You asked for opportunities. I think that is one for sure.
I think someday we'll look at the Brisbane building as a poster child for this phase of downtown's development. Peter has done a marvelous job of choreographing what's in that building.
Absolutely.
So you've got an art gallery, you've got a place of convening for the public, you've got a restaurant that runs a noontime business with one restaurant and an evening time restaurant. In addition, thinking about the housing on top of that, it's exactly the mix of uses and the street frontage that brings life to downtown.
His father would be proud.
Yeah, I think he would. I think he would.
Circling back to Queen City Revisited, Patrick Kaler from Visit Buffalo Niagara is screaming they need more hotel rooms in downtown Buffalo. Has that come up in Queen City Revisited?
You bet.
Looking at some of these buildings as hospitality destinations?
I think one of the things we have to be clear about is that everything's on the table. And the hotel need, there's a real market, according to Patrick. And so thinking about the Grand and the possibility that it finds new life, and thinking about any of those 10 or 11 large empty buildings and saying, what about hotel? And hotel is not a lot more difficult to do than residential reuse properties.
But you have to get the banks to buy into this.
You know, Jake said it, the interest rates are at a level now where essentially any flex you had to pencil out a project gets spent on interest and you don't get it done. So we need more discrete tools that administratively help us with the capital side and the bank and financing side of building. And concurrently, we need to bring the public sector work in parallel with those private investments so that we're reinforcing and improving the likelihood of those private projects being successful.
What do we need to really spark? We're talking, we're doing a lot of talking. What do we need to get shovels in the ground?
A toolkit. Yeah. a toolkit that has more levers to pull than the current one, because the we're not able to finance many of the projects that we want to make work. Peter's struggling with that, and it's an expensive proposition, for example, in the Brisbane field.
And the other variable that wasn't as challenging when I started is construction costs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Since the pandemic, they've escalated immensely. And it's due to labor, it's due to product. There's inflation everywhere. And there has been since the pandemic. It's not getting better.
Now we're talking tariffs too, which will add to this. And there's some high ticket construction projects going on, which is draining the workforce. The stadium, the Amazon project out in Niagara County, those two come to mind.
That's true, Jim. That made all the other projects much more difficult to find labor and pricing that is competitive.
So it is one of many roadblocks out there.
And look at the Bills Stadium.
Yeah.
How that has exponentially gone over budget. This is the worst climate to be building right now.
Yep.
They missed that by billions.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not talking a small number here. And, the smartest people they could find did those estimates, and they were probably very good estimates when they were done. But no one foresaw this spike. And that really is a major detriment to private developers.
And I think that's one of the things that is giving Terry Pegula pause about what he does with the arena, because he's saying, well, you know, we thought this was going to pencil out here, and now it's up here. And what am I going to do? What are we going to do with the arena? Especially now there's tariffs and other conditions, too, that are clouding it. There's a push for more affordable housing. It's starting. The Governor Hochul is pushing for it. When people talk about affordable housing, it's not always Section 8. It could be someone, the college graduates fresh out of college who are earning $30,000 a year, and they need a place to live. And you talked about this earlier. How do we find, how do we create apartments or condos or some sort of living quarters in downtown to fit into the affordable housing mandates?
Well, the Department of Housing and Community Renewal has a big toolkit for exactly that group of sort of workforce housing that's very low income people. So you've got a market, and you've got an ability to do that. And a lot of that's happening. So look at what's going into the Erie Canal Harbor, look at Marine Towers, look at town gardens. You're seeing large populations of that workforce level housing supported in construction. So the subsidy and tools are there for that occupancy. What we call for in the Queen City Hub revisit is a diverse population downtown, a neighborhood of neighborhoods that really reflects us as a full city, which means you need a full deck of cards. And wrong metaphor. You need a full way of understanding the real diversity of our city and then finding ways to house them downtown. As I say, we've got the upper end well covered. We don't have the middle class very well covered because of the cost of construction, because of the level of interest rates involved. And we don't have the very poorest among us covered. We have a homeless problem, and it's adding value and problem focus for downtown as an example. So finding ways to address the full dance card and everybody in it.
Does downtown have a stigma or a perception problem?
Right now it does. We surveyed 1,500 people as part of this review of the Queen City Hub and found that 9 of 10 people visiting downtown don't feel safe. And it's not because there's more crime. It's because the crime that's there is more visible because there's fewer people on the street. And it's also because of the kind of stillness of vacant storefronts. So strategically, if we could address those two things in a very short time, and probably not with a lot of money, you could change the perception very quickly. When we first did Queen City Hub, the first series of priorities were security and safety downtown. And in a year, we found ourselves able to put that to rest because of the way the Mazzaiello administration managed the police force supporting downtown. And you can imagine we could do that again. And then we could also go to work and activate some of those street front properties as a very high first priority. When that's attractive, I'm more inclined to go downtown. I'm more inclined to want to go to work downtown. And so I'll make choices between whether I'm working at home or there. But if home is downtown, I'm more likely to go to work.
Jake, here.
Yeah, I think Bob's right on with that. I couldn't have said it better for sure. I don't know what the answer is. I'm encouraged to hear Bob say that, you know, with a small investment, we might be able to accomplish a lot in terms of changing the perception on safety and in filling those storefronts that we've lost. There are reasons to be optimistic. I'm excited about Peter Marlett Jr.'s proposal to put a soccer stadium in. I hope that comes to fruition. We could use some improved transportation. Our city has always kind of never really found, we don't operate the way other cities do. Our public transportation is not ideal. It's there, but it's not ideal.
We also have to finish cars on Main Street.
Yeah. I think that's something we could also be optimistic about. I mean, Canal Side's a success story. Larkinville's a success story. The medical campus is.
So Seneca Street.
And Seneca Street is coming. There's work to be done there. But property values in that neighborhood have really made a huge leap forward. The streetscape is coming along. There's been a lot of development activity since we first started down there. The city's promised us a streetscape project that's going to make a big improvement. They're going to start that this summer. So there's reason to be optimistic. Our neighborhoods, I think, are doing well. They didn't have the exodus of the commercial real estate that the downtown had.
I really agree with the optimism Jake is expressing. It's a piece of geography to work on. If you think about the Cobblestone District and the Erie Canal Harbor Development Corporation's area and Seneca, and if you think about the medical campus and then you think about Larkin, it's a mile, a mile, a mile in a triangle. Mm-hmm. And you got Michigan Avenue coming to life in a much stronger way than ever before. And you see things moving east. And in the infill of that triangle with those anchors, you really have development opportunities in the future and ways to build the relationship back to downtown. And so the east side of downtown starts to really be a thriving place.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because
Centennial Park's going to be a huge addition when that's finished. Yeah. Ralph Wilson Park. Yeah. We have properties right in that neighborhood, so we're excited for that.
Even putting up the bridge was a huge psychological lift.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really was.
It's our signature bridge.
Yeah. Finally, we got one. That's funny.
And we don't have to worry about birds flying into it.
I hope not.
Sorry. That's bringing up bad memories. As we wrap up last couple minutes, if you had a magic wand, what would you do to change downtown right now to get us moving forward again?
Get safety and security fully under control. Activate those street fronts. Go full speed ahead on the development of the 10 or 12, we're not talking hundreds, we're talking 10 or 12 major buildings that could be converted to residential or hotel or mixed use kind of occupancies. Those three things all by themselves would be huge. The broader picture is one of build out the toolkit that enables us to develop, create the alignment with the public investments in the public realm, and do everything you can to program and activate the life downtown. Remember Thursday at the Square? Remember some of those things that brought people to downtown venues? That's what we're looking for.
Is that a sneak preview for Queen City Revisited?
Yes, it is.
You know, in addition to those things Bob laid out there, which I agree with, and I mentioned this a little before, you know, our transportation. I don't like the fact that our downtown is bisected by an expressway. I think, I know this is pie in the sky, but you said magic wand. So, yeah. You know, I would like to see that act as a delivery system to the downtown.
Yes.
We have a beltway. Mm-hmm. You want to get to Niagara Falls, you know, we've got the way to get there. You don't have to go through our downtown to get there. Those highways should deliver people to the downtown. I'm for taking from Louisiana Street to the Peace Bridge exit and making that a parkway. Just the way people want to make the Skajakwita Parkway. I think that would be phenomenal.
Well, the template's been done in Niagara Falls.
Yeah.
They took that from the
exactly
to the bridge. They made it, it's now the Niagara Parkway.
And, you know, that's just an urban lifestyle improvement. I think it would make the downtown more livable, more enjoyable. And then, you know, there's talk of extending the metro rail. I think that would be, again, magic wand. I would love to see that happen. If we could somehow connect UB North to our you know, waterfront, that would be just sensational.
Absolutely. I mean, it has to be convenient. And to get from UB North to downtown, you have to take either UB shuttle bus or whatever NFTA bus line is to the university, to the South Campus, and then take the Metro Rail in. That's too inconvenient. You're not going to.
Yeah.
And shouldn't we have a Metro Rail that goes to the airport?
We should. Cleveland does.
I mean, everyone else does.
Yep. Cleveland does. Phoenix does.
And that would really help the downtown. Because people then wouldn't really need to have a car. Today, even Buffalo, if you live here, even if you can walk to work, you still need a car. Very few of our tenants. We have some properties with off-site parking, and people will nest their cars there. But it really, people want their cars. They want to be able to get to their car every day. We're not there yet in terms of really creating a lifestyle in this community that doesn't rely on the automobile.
Well, part of the problem is we're probably too spread out. And as you said, public transportation is hit and miss. I know Leadership Buffalo, maybe about 10 years ago, they had their classmates go from their houses to the nearest supermarket via public transportation. I think the quickest anyone could do it was like 35 minutes. It really was kind of eye-opening. I remember talking to Althea about their studies, as informal as it was and unscientific as it was, but it spoke volumes that we have public transportation, but is it in the right places? And you hear office parks out in Amherst and Orchard Park saying, we need public transportation to get workers to us. You know, there's some companies that supply their own, but you do need public transportation. And if it would be seamless between downtown and the suburbs for whatever reason, that'd be a huge boost, not only for downtown, but the entire region.
And there's something about a metro rail or a trolley system that's a lot more user-friendly than buses. When I visit other cities, I'll commonly hop on a subway or a metro rail. Mm-hmm. But I would never really try to figure out the bus system.
Yeah. You can't.
Yeah.
I've been intrigued and interested and excited by the mobility planning, particularly alternative modes of transportation, downtown specifically. And there's a plan in place for that. I've also been excited, as you are, about the possibility of parkway transformation on the highway that separates us from the lake. And then if you flip that and look at the Elm Oak Corridor and you say, how much more friendly can that be for pedestrian traffic east to west? And now we really create the linkages and connections, as you say, feeding into the city. So transportation is a big, big play, but it's got lots of dimensions to it. I'm also really happy that the city has a plan to take Erie Street from Main Street to the water, mm-hmm. and really understand that as another finger in, because all of that energy in the waterfront ought to be part of our downtown experience.
We had that with Genesee Street till they cut it off with the Hyatt, the convention center.
Exactly. And all of that is actually documented in the Queen City Hub the first time around. It's one of the 100-plus recommendations that we haven't been able to move on yet. But I believe firmly that it's not pie in the sky. We can do this.
Are you optimistic about where we're headed with downtown? I know we're in a lull right now.
Yeah.
But is there reason to be optimistic?
I am. I'm bullish on it, but I think it's an occupational hazard. You don't become an architect and planner and not assume things can be better.
Yeah, but you have a track record to back it up.
Yeah. Well, I think there's reason to be optimistic because we did get out the other side of the pandemic and we are working on it. I think it's going to take business leadership. The city can't do it by itself. It's going to take leadership at the county and at the state level as well. And I think the banks and foundations are going to have to weigh in and give us some support to make this happen better.
Jake, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm optimistic for sure. Like I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of reasons to be. If I were a young man starting my career today in Buffalo, I think there's a lot more opportunity than there was back in the 80s, late 70s when I graduated. People are not fleeing. People are arriving. And there was a point where, I don't know if it's true anymore, but we were leading the demographic of the age groups between 28 and 30-something moving into a city. In fact, that demographic in Buffalo was growing faster than anywhere else in the country, relative to our size, of course. But that was hugely encouraging. And, you know, I think 43 North is a huge program that has really been another giant success story, bringing young entrepreneurs to our city. I think there's so much upside there. And, you know, there's a lot of smart people doing a lot of creative things. And we still have a really strong creative class here in this community. Young people that are doing their own thing and
can we
and
keep
thriving.
Them here? Can yeah. we keep them here?
And they want to be here because they've come to know and love this community.
Because that's one of the worst things we did was export all the UB grads, all the Buff State grads. They did their 4 years here and they went on their merry way. Not necessarily in the 716 area code.
And you know, Jim, I think back then they grew up hearing what a woe is me place I live in, mm-hmm. From maybe their parents. And they couldn't wait to get out of town. I don't think people talk that way anymore. I think people talk about how great it is to live here and how the seasons are so wonderful and how you can raise a family in an environment that where people care about one another. And that's invaluable. We're also, you know, considered a climate refuge city.
Yeah.
Because we have a temperate climate, we have fresh water, we have an underutilized infrastructure. So You know, that's a real thing. Let's not lose sight of the fact that we're better positioned to deal with these problems than a lot of places.
That was Bob Shibley and Jake Schneider. We'll close out today's show with a conversation with Mary-Kate Loftus and Lauren Schelger from Impressia Bank. The two sit down with Naila and Sardi Cotillo to discuss how banking practices impact women entrepreneurs and how to address the needs of the rapidly growing she economy.
So I'm going to start with Mary-Kate. Can you start a little bit about telling us the story of Impressia's banking system, how you all got here, and the inspiration for the founding of it?
Absolutely. It is a, first of all, it's an honor to be here. I'm so excited. Lauren and I are big fans, so we're thrilled to be on the show today. The story of the founding of the bank is so fascinating. So it was about, I'm going to give you the condensed version, but it's really interesting. About 2.5 years ago, there was a new CEO at the parent company of Impressia called CNB Bank. New CEO comes in. He goes on a listening tour. He meets all these phenomenal women leaders, and it's the head of commercial banking, the head of treasury management, all these functions of the bank. And he looked at our customer base and said, well, wait a second. Why does our customer base not reflect the fact that we have all these amazing women leaders? He asked the question. This group convenes, and they take a look, and they say, you know what? No banks are really doing a great job. A steering committee ends up forming. They report directly to the board. And the person that we report into, Angela Wilcoxon, she's based out of Cleveland. She's the head of commercial banking. She just said, you know, there's many options and ways we could go about this, but the best way is let's actually form a fully funded division that operates across all the states that we operate in. So although we're headquartered in Buffalo at the Electric Tower, we actually have teams that are in New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Virginia. And we have a full online presence, and that's now going on almost 2 years. So we're approaching our 2-year anniversary.
Oh my God, that's incredible. Can you talk a little bit about the mission of the bank? I mean, that story alone, to be able to, we're headquartered here, but you're all over.
Yes.
Is awesome.
So our purpose is the financial and professional development of women. We are a federally regulated bank, so all customers are welcome. So you do not have to be a woman to be a customer. We are here for everybody. And we have many, many customers who are men as well. But our purpose is, again, the financial and professional development of women. The way we do that, our mission is to redefine the banker-client relationship. And that's really where Lauren comes in.
Yeah. So we are really trying to deliver banking in a way that's impactful for women, because historically, the banking system has not been built to serve women, especially not women entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. So we've developed a product set and a way of delivering banking services that we think really uniquely services the needs of women who are busy, who need a single point of contact, and who need, you know, often a space to be vulnerable with their finances, mm-hmm. Without judgment or intimidation. And that's really, I think, the difference that we're trying to deliver.
Yeah, we're going to go off of that because you totally took my next question. What makes you different? But that's such a unique approach. Can you talk a little bit about women specifically that are trying to get into the business? For folks that don't know, startup costs are really difficult. A lot of folks don't really understand that is a really male-dominated space. How are you all unique in the sense of, like, I can come to you and may not know anything and not feel intimidated? Because I know that's something that a lot of women kind of, you know, I wouldn't say necessarily it's a complaint, but there's a fear factor of that. I don't feel like I know everything going into a banking situation.
I think it's interesting. In our culture, when you talk about starting a business, a lot of us immediately think of sort of tech startups, mm-hmm. which is, you know, a really male-dominated space. But if you look at the rate of new business starts, women are starting businesses at a much higher rate than men are in this country. And it's just that they're starting smaller businesses, right? They're starting the Main Street businesses that are serving our communities, the restaurants, the salons, the, you know, the businesses that make communities communities. And we know that those women don't get a lot of support or a lot of, there's not venture capital dollars that are flowing to them. So what we're trying to do is provide the education, which there are a lot of community services, which I'm sure we'll talk about, that are available here in Buffalo and in all of our markets that help deliver education, help deliver loan guarantee programs to help women start those businesses. But really what we want to provide is that safe space to come and say, hey, I want to do this and I don't know where to start, or I don't know, you know, if I have enough financial wherewithal to do this, is it a smart choice or is it too risky? And we want to be that sounding board and be able to offer sound guidance.
Which is really important because a lot of folks start businesses and then they don't realize what they're getting into till midway through. And then you're like, okay, I need a loan. I don't know how to do it. And then it becomes really stressful. So to be able to have those services initially where folks can kind of feel like they're getting a leg up as opposed to trying to catch up is really important.
That's a great point. The many customers that Lauren's been helping, they are, have actually been in business for 5 years, wow, for 8 years, for 10 years, and they got to the point they are, and then they say, oh my gosh, I've grown so much. Now I need different help. I need different advice. I need to be in different rooms with different people to be able to continue this growth. And that's where the value of Lauren comes in.
Yeah. And speaking of a different approach, innovation's really big in banking right now. And I know you all have a digital approach because you all are everywhere. Can you speak a little bit to that? Because, you know, I have a dad who still does the banking very much the traditional mm-hmm. way. So can you speak a little bit to the digital trends that Impressia Bank has?
Sure. So we do have, you know, for people who want to do business with us in person, in any of our markets, the New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Ohio, we have a branch network. People can come in and do business with us directly. And we really do want to provide that personal touch. So every one of our clients has a banker, an individual person they can reach out to. But we're also national. So we have clients all over the country right now. And for those clients, we had to build out a, you know, full suite of digital services. So if we have a client who doesn't want to go into a branch, they don't need to. If they're in California, they can deal with us entirely virtually. Really, from the start of, you know, opening an account to applying for a business loan to daily operations, making deposits, they can do 100% of that online digitally.
Wow, because that actually stops a lot of folks from doing. Yeah. I know I'm a component. I'm like, oh, I have to actually go into the bank. It's like,
Well, one of the things I think, and I was with my father on Saturday, and I was showing him, and he's a client. But you can text. So whether you can text Lauren, for example, directly, Jess, who's on a support member of our team, or you can text directly to the bank's customer service, real people write you back. It's not a bot.
Oh, wow.
And so like those are the kinds of things where like it doesn't require a heavy technology lift or these like really advanced digital capabilities to be able to do it. It's really thinking from a common sense perspective, what do real people need and what's the best way to be able to get there? I think that, you know, as we talk a lot about like banking humanly and all that means is it's really looking at like what do people need and then figuring out the best way to be able to give it to them.
Because the bots kind of, I wouldn't say weird people out, but in some instances, right, folks don't, especially when it comes to their money.
There's a lack of trust.
There is a lack of trust when it comes to, you know, this idea of like the digital world and going into digital banking, people having access to your accounts and your data. But to be able to speak to someone directly, even if they're, you know, even if it's virtual, you still know that you have that human touch, which is so important.
Well, another thing too, when you think about making sure, though, if people want digital, like we're able to, and it's Impressia and Bank on Buffalo here locally, you can apply for a home equity, a mortgage, get pre-qualified. You can apply for a business loan. Everything can be done online, but it's your choice. So if you don't want to do that and you want to talk to somebody, you're welcome to come do that.
Exactly. And there are people who do sort of a hybrid of both, right? They want the ability to, you know, do everything online. And then when something looks weird online or they just aren't at their computer, they want to be able to call. And I have lots of clients who only reach out to me when there's, you know, something amiss or they're traveling. And that's precisely why we're here. That's how we're set up to do business.
Yeah. So I know you all are a full service commercial bank. Can you explain, I know we just talked about that, but can you explain to our listeners what that means exactly? Because when, you know, people see new banks, because most times people have like kind of known about the same banks their entire life. Can you explain a little bit more about what full service means?
Yeah, so we have, my background is in commercial banking and commercial lending. So we have a full suite of commercial banking services. So for clients who are looking for financing to purchase a building, to grow their manufacturing, to finance their working capital, we have a full suite of products that can help them. And I think what's unique for Impressia is, although we're coming up on our 2-year anniversary, we're a division of a larger organization, CNB Bank. So we're in the fortunate position of being able to lend right away to our customers with a relatively high cap of loans that we can originate, even though we're still, you know, in that rapid growth phase of our deposit gathering.
It's so interesting because a little bit of about banking that most people kind of like shy away from is this idea of financial literacy and being educated. So yes, the whole full service component, yes, we need that. We understand that. But the financial literacy part is something that folks are kind of like, why do I need to know anything about that? And I know you all have some initiatives when they say, you know, I've figured out how to live off of like $20 and feed five kids, right? So, yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the education services that you're providing?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you asked that because I think we find that for a lot of women, even like whether it's in their household or in their businesses, some of that financial management is outsourced to another party, right? Whether it's a spouse mm-hmm. or an accountant, you know, they have people that take care of that so they can focus on what they're excellent at. But a base level of financial literacy is really important to empower women to make decisions that will benefit them in the near term and the long term. Whether it's in your household, understanding kind of the budgeting and the tools that are available to you and sort of how you manage your credit score. We provide services to help with just like quick, you know, 2 to 5 minute videos with little quizzes at the end. Any of our customers have access to do that. I would encourage any of our listeners to check out our website, impressiabank.bank, and find, you know, our resources tab. And there's a whole bunch of just like quick, easy, free tools that we just want out in the community so they know how to, you know, manage those things. And it can really save a lot of time and money in the future by having a couple of basics down. And then when you look at from the business side, you know, there are women out there who've been running their businesses successfully for many years, but they haven't had to pay close attention to the way they manage their balance sheet, or, you know, they see their profit and loss statement at the end of the year and it shows that there is, you know, a lot of revenue generated, but not necessarily seeing that in their own personal net worth at the end of the year. And we have a lot of tools as well as sort of we have our masterclass, Women in Business Academy masterclass, where a cohort of our clients are able to go through and get a real like crash course in how you manage that, how you get that control back and make good decisions for your business and for your own personal net worth.
Yeah. And, you know, that's one thing of being able to manage, but it's also it's another thing to secure those funds. And in underrepresented communities, particularly a lot of minority owned businesses, it's been difficult to secure a lot of funding, particularly in this region. Can you talk a little bit about how Impressio may be a little different and why someone, particularly if there's a minority owner or underrepresented business, why they should bank with you all?
Yeah, I mean, I know for us, we have this specific mission to try and meet the women's needs in the community. Mm-hmm. And that's really led us to develop a more hands-on and more thoughtful approach when companies and individuals are trying to secure loans, secure funding. Sometimes that means, you know, we can lend directly. Other times that means partnering with another organization. We are fortunate in New York State to have quite a few partner organizations that we can rely on for loan guarantees, for matching funds. And we actually have, we have a colleague who sits in our Cleveland office who she can help our clients sift through, you know, what are like grant applications that are worth your time to apply to? What are grant applications that really, for the amount of time and the type of business that you have, are it's not going to be worth the effort? So I think it's not only the loans that we're able to originate. It's also sort of that navigating through the various loan programs at the state, federal, and local levels, as well as the potential for grant opportunities.
And I think Lauren said that beautifully. The where Martha's work comes to life is all of our customers get access to a text newsfeed. I don't know of any other banks that are doing this. When you talk about innovation and financial services, it's really exciting. Every customer gets a regular recurring text alert. Now, sometimes we'll say we're only going to send these to Buffalo. Sometimes they go to Cleveland. But what they do is they, when Martha does her work, she goes and says, oh, there's an opportunity coming, whether it's educational, networking, or grant money. Our customers get an alert that say, this has been opened up. You may qualify for this. Take a look. And we've had so many customers that have come back to us and said, thank you so much. If you hadn't sent me that text alert, I totally would have missed the opportunity. It does not mean you're going to be able to get everything. It does not mean that automatically, to Lauren's point, we're more of a platform to connect you. But the fact that there's a bank that's willing to be that connection, I think is it's been really valuable to a lot of people.
Because I think a lot of folks, they don't understand the access is just as important as sometimes the securing of the funds. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't even know that a grant, let's say, exists, then you totally missed out on it and didn't even try.
That's right.
Not because you didn't want to, but just because you didn't even know it existed.
That's right. That's right. And as we've gone through this like past 2 years, what we've learned is there are so many resources that are out there that if only people knew that it was out there, they'd be able to leverage it. And the more we learn, the more that we're able to, you know, be able to connect those dots for people.
And so the idea of a bank having impact sometimes seems like that is counterintuitive to what most people think. But you all are really coming in strong. You're 2 years, not necessarily 2 years old, but kind of 2 years old mm-hmm. in our world here. What are you seeing in terms of impact in the community and people like receiving that you all are giving them access in a way that they're not historically used to?
Yeah. Go ahead, Lauren.
I was going to say, I mean, I think one of the things that I've noticed, even in the, you know, the time that we've been here in Buffalo, is we're able to build this network that, I mean, albeit some of it did exist, right? We have strong mm-hmm. women's interest networks here in Buffalo, which has been wonderful. And we've been able to build on that and hopefully add some value. It's really a lot about, as Mary Kate said, making connections. So we now have, you know, accountants and attorneys, bookkeepers, marketing agencies that are in our client base that we can connect with a new business and say, hey, this is part of the, you know, Impressia family. This is another person that, you know, we know that they will share transparent pricing. Then the new business owner is able to share, you know, what their goals are. And, in, you know, not 100% of the time is there a new, you know, business relationship formed, but it's a new connection that then we've really seen that become more strongly interwoven. And we've had a couple of really wonderful events to celebrate our customers and to welcome in this network where, you know, you just see in the conversations that happen and in the energy in the room, it's really been fulfilling to, I think, to our clients, to our prospects. And it's been able to, I think, create some momentum. We've had a couple of really strong customer wins here locally, which has been wonderful to see somebody who's gone from like a dream or an idea or, you know, a business that's operating but not on a growth trajectory to really like hit that milestone mm-hmm. and see the growth not just for them and their family, but for the whole community.
In terms of networking, women do not usually like to talk about money. And it's one of those things that's very taboo, particularly when it comes to business. Because like you all said, it's like, oh, my husband's going to take care of her, or my dad or brother, or, you know, whoever that's male typically is in charge of the money. How do you all go about kind of coaching some of your clients to say, OK, you need to get this deal done. You have to, you know, as it being forward, you know, what are some tips that you have for business owners in terms of in those connections and networking to ask for what you want?
Yeah. I mean, I think I'd love to share, we've had a couple of events that are specifically around this, about getting women comfortable and understanding the importance of having these conversations, candid conversations about finances. We had a lovely event last summer, you know, that really, I think, drove home the importance of, you know, what can happen if you don't plan for the future, if you cede that decision-making to another person. And we've also been having, you know, much smaller gatherings. So that was a large gathering where the goal was just to get the message across of this is important. And then we followed up on that by having smaller group meetings to say, we're inviting in, you know, a group of our clients and saying, we're going to have a candid conversation about money. We have a couple of conversation starters and we share, you know, whether it's for their business or for them personally, what are the financial goals? And let's talk about, is that, you know, is that scary to you to say that that's your goal? And why is that scary? I think, and even across the gender divide, money is an uncomfortable mm-hmm. conversation mm-hmm. for people. It's a taboo topic. And so encouraging people to be vulnerable about it is the key of it. Because what gets missed is that if you don't have those conversations and candidly say, like, I'm raising funds right now, then you miss that opportunity mm-hmm. entirely. And there, that's you know, I think something that women disproportionately are missing out on.
Mm-hmm. And I think to build on that, women learn often, share and learn through stories. So that's why it's so important what Lauren was saying, to convene conversations, to bring people together at the event that Lauren was referencing last summer. So it's a woman that leads a large nonprofit in Western New York. And she shared her story about her husband's sudden passing. What connected with people was they said, oh, my gosh, because you're working so hard, you're taking care of others. You don't take the time, though, to step back and make sure you understand where your money is. You understand how to log into online banking. You know where everything was set up. And then they could all feel for themselves, that could happen to me. Today, I'm in that same boat. I wouldn't, you know, I could be at risk of losing my house, my car, et cetera, if my loved one passed away. But I think sharing stories is like almost the gateway to allow people to more step into that space where they feel comfortable. The most important thing, though, is taking action. Like, if we could leave anyone with a thought today, it is time is the most important thing. Don't lose a day, don't lose a minute, and take action to be able to make sure you're set.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because we're going to deep dive a little bit later into Ooh. What happens. So that's when people kind of get stuck in these in predicaments, particularly what's happening in the world. But why is it important to bank? And I know, to some listeners, this may sound kind of like an odd question because, you know, the assumption is everyone banks. But in certain communities, people actually do not bank at mm-hmm. all and don't have banks. You know, I work with a lot with college students, and it may be the first time they've, you know, are opening an account, or they may not feel like they need to have an account. What's the importance of having a bank and having a bank that you trust and feel comfortable with?
So I think for many people, you know, the younger generation does their banking, you know, looking for the best high yield savings rate. And then they have an online, like couple of platforms, a Cash App or a Venmo, and they get by that way. And that's for on the younger generation. There are also, as you mentioned, like we are very aware that there are segments of the population that either can't get a bank account mm-hmm. or choose not to deal with a bank for a variety of reasons.
Cash under the,
exactly.
the mattress, mm-hmm. right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think the real reason why you need a bank is not for when everything is going smoothly. Mm-hmm. It's for when there's a problem, right? When you do need financial support, when you're looking to buy a home, when you're looking to start a business, having that banking relationship is crucial to being able to, you know, support your credit score, to, you know, secure those funds. People sometimes don't realize that financial institutions, data is reported up federally. So there are services that are aggregating that data. Even if there's somebody who is only doing their banking, you know, with a high yield savings account, and they use the buy now, pay later apps for, you know, Uber Eats, that gets reported, right? That data is aggregated. And so those behaviors of online, you know, purchasing, they're available. And if you are not taking control and taking an active interest in how your financial data is managed and working with a reputable banking institution, you're potentially at risk of, you know, having a credit score that's impacted negatively and without even realizing it.
And sometimes I know, especially for younger generations that you mentioned, it's really difficult because they're getting these extremely high rates that they can't really pay back. Mm-hmm. And so they're going in like, oh, I can get something very quickly. Mm-hmm. And they're not really knowing what they're signing up for. And they're like, oh, yeah, I can just do this. I just found this app online. And then they're trying to pay back all these things. And to your point about their credit score, they can't bring their credit score up.
And that's why the financial literacy is so important. Like, start now before you get yourself into any sort of situation, so that you can plan ahead for the future.
Right.
I'm Naila Ansari-Cotillo, and I've had the honor of just chatting away with some pretty awesome people. I have the president of Impressia Bank, Mary Kate Loftus, and I have the vice president of regional relationship management. I got that. Got that right? Lauren Schellinger. And we've really been diving into banking, Impressia's mission, a women-ran bank, which is incredible and amazing. And we left off, you know, talking about the importance of banking and having a bank. And right now we have so many federal layoffs. We have a lot of folks losing their job at rapid pace, and a lot of folks really don't know what to do. So a bank like Impressia, what ways can we help some of these folks that are in these difficult situations that we just started leaning on before we went to break?
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. There's a lot of uncertainty right now. Even the smartest banker can't predict what's going to happen with rates and unemployment rate. And that's scary for a lot of people. So I think, as we were talking about before the break, having a trusted financial advisor, which for many people, it should be your banker, right? You should have a person, the person and the institution that's holding your money, you should have a person that you can reach out to there who you trust to give you sound information. And that's really, I think, what Impressia is trying to do. Rather than offer just a product set, we want to be able to have that conversation and allow people to come in and say candidly, like, okay, I find myself in this position. I've lost my, job at the VA, and I have this debt that's outstanding. How do I get out of this? And we want to be that resource who can say, these are the options that we have available, right? Because what we know happens is that in the absence of that, candid conversation and evaluation, sometimes the answer is not pretty, right? Like, right. Sometimes the solution is a difficult one. But without that, you end up in a much worse position, right? People tend to rely on, there are, for better or worse, a lot of credit providers, non-bank lenders who are out there in the market who are offering, buy now, pay later options and, quick and easy, very high interest loans. So it's better to have that candid conversation with somebody that you trust locally than to have to take out sort of a national high interest loan and find out 6 months down the line that you're in a worse position than you were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think those are great points. And I think that proactively, because people do feel so uncertain, as Lauren said, it's scary. Like, it's a lot of uncertainty right now happening. What people can do is think about what they can control. They can control if they have a budget. Mm-hmm. And maybe to some people, they say, a budget? I don't even know how to set up a budget. We mentioned financial literacy mm-hmm. tools. Like, it's very easy actually to establish, even if you start just with the basics. The next thing would be look at your savings and really look at what are your needs versus your wants. Be proactive about setting money aside. And as Lauren was saying, if you have a relationship with a banker, you can say, well, I've set aside $10,000, $20,000 or more. How do I get the most out of that and lock it down so I can get a great return? But I think not being afraid, the most important thing is if you're afraid to kind of like take an honest look at where you're at, that's where you really expose yourself to danger. So you're better off taking a moment, evaluating your current position, and then saying, what is my plan going forward in the event something does happen?
And Impressia Bank, especially because I'm sitting here with these two lovely women, there's not an embarrassment there. And I think that's a huge thing that folks really feel embarrassed about their funds mm-hmm. and where they are financially because they feel like they made poor decisions. And so they're going to be judged on that. And with Impressia Bank, just sitting with you two, I feel so comfortable to be like, okay, look, I really messed up here. How can I fix this? Because a lot of times folks think they need to spend a lot of money on financial advisors, if they even know what that is. And so can you speak a little bit to, yes, people need financial advisors if they want to and if they can afford it, but the bank is also there to help you, to guide you in a way that doesn't cost you mm-hmm. an arm and a leg.
Right. I mean, you made two excellent points there. One is that we often feel like there's a moral judgment associated with monetary decisions. Mm-hmm. And, are there outliers where people just make silly choices with money? Sure. But I think in many cases, there's no room for moral judgment, right? People are making ends meet. People are trying to do the things that need to be done to live their life. And so we really do try and, take any moral judgment out of it and make it a conversation about, brass tacks, like what is practical right now. The other point that you raised is that, for people who are looking for financial advice, your bank is holding your money and a bank is deriving a benefit from holding that money, mm-hmm. right? That mm-hmm. there, you shouldn't have to pay if your needs are simple, right? There's obviously a space in our financial services industry to have, financial advisors who are managing, complex portfolios, and they're, they deserve to be compensated for that.
And that will do it for Producer Picks of the Week. We thank our guests, Bob Shibley, Jake Schneider, Mary Kate Loftus, and Lauren Schallinger. If you missed anything or just want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts, including the full individual episodes aired in today's compilation. Each episode is online at wbfo.org. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.